Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
All the time that I spent writing articles about music and writing reviews, I wrote hundreds of record reviews, and I realized fairly quickly that from my point of view, the last thing that anybody wanted to know was whether I liked an album or whether I thought it was good, and then what the most important thing for me to do is describe it well. That's what a good review does. It describes the music so that you have some idea of whether you think you might like it or not, and. Debates about what bluegrass is or what good music is or all that stuff, just I'm not interested.
Welcome to the Travis Book Happy Hour Podcast. I'm Travis Book. This episode is brought to you by Thompson Guitars, makers of fine instruments handmade with love in Sisters, Oregon. The podcast is presented by Americana Vibes and the Bluegrass Situation, and our show is part of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can dive into all things roots music anytime at thebluegrasssituation.com. When the String Dusters were in Nashville around 2006 and 2007, our dobro player lived next door to John Weisberger in Madison, Tennessee, right on the Cumberland River. There were two houses on the property. Andy lived in one, John lived in the other. I was sleeping in Andy's guest room, and there were regular pickin' parties at the compound, as we refer to it now. A few years ago, I suggested John move to Brevard. He looked into it, and I'm happy to say I'm now neighbors with my favorite co-writing partner. John has written with just about everyone in bluegrass, but recently, his most notable songs have been with Billy Strings. In fact, John helped write California Sober, a song Billy recently recorded with Willie Nelson. A music historian, writer, bassist, and king of the charcoal grill, I was thrilled to get to know more about one of the most liked people in bluegrass. This episode was recorded live in February of 2021.
Live from the Gray Eagle in Asheville, the Pearl of Carolina, it's the Travis Book Happy Hour. With special guest John Weisberger and the Happy Hour House Band featuring Tommy Marr. And now, your host, Travis Book.
Thank you, Bill. And thank you, studio audience. I think it's called Wasted on the Way. Off to a bad start. Look around me now, can see my life before me, running circles round the way it used to be. I am older now, I have more than what I wanted, wish that I had started long before I did. And there's so much time wasted underneath the way, time we have wasted on the way. So much water moving underneath the bridge, let the water come and carry us away. Question all the answers, envy all the dancers who had all the nerve. Look around you now, you
must go for what you want. Look at all those who did and got what they deserve. And there's so much time wasted every single day. Time we have wasted on the way. So much water moving underneath the bridge. Let the water come and carry us away. Let the water come and carry us away.
Man, there's so much to say. But I'm going to wait till he's up here, and it's part of the interview. Please make welcome the one and only John Weisberger.
Hey, man.
Hey. Come on out. Make yourself at home, man.
Thank you. Oh, man, this microphone stand is wilting.
It's all right. I'm going to sit on a stool. You want to sit?
I'll sit, yes.
Man, how's it going?
It's going good.
Good.
Given that we're in the, is this going to be a snow apocalypse, ice apocalypse?
You know, it doesn't. I think we're going to be fine on this side of the mountain.
All right.
It's bad everywhere else. Man, thanks for coming on the show.
Absolutely. Well, I've been looking forward to it. I was hoping you would ask me for a while. Now it's my dream has come true. So,
even your dreams can
even
come true.
Even my dreams come true.
Let's get a little context.
Okay.
Let's talk a little history. What I'll do is I'll kind of walk people through, and you can help me narrate.
All right.
Okay. Instead of being like, John, tell us how you got into music. I'll tell you how you got into music.
All right. I'm be interested.
How about
to hear
that? So, John, you were born in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
I was.
Where is that? Is that Southern?
Yellow Springs is it's outside of Dayton, so it's Southwest Ohio. Yeah.
Well, that's where my mother's from. Is that general area? Interestingly
nice
enough.
Area.
And you took up e-bass, electric bass, in your early teens.
Yes, I did. I heard the Beatles, mildly interesting, and then I heard a B.B. King record, and I was hooked on blues. And so I started playing guitar, actually, and wanted to get a little band together with a couple of friends, and we needed a bass player, and so I became the bass player.
Tale as old as time.
Really?
You know, it's funny. You know, you started playing e-bass in your teens, and that's something that we've got in common. Here's something else that we have in common. Both of our first gigs in Nashville were at the Station Inn as part of the Sidemen with Terry Eldridge.
Nice. Yeah.
So we've got that.
Mine is on video, though.
Oh, wow.
It's on YouTube. There's a little snippet from the New Year's, like the first show that I played as a Nashville resident was the New Year's Eve show at the Station Inn with Richard Bailey from the Steel Drivers and
awesome.
Terry Eldridge and Mike Compton, and I can't remember who all else, but it was a pretty spectacular band, and I was just hanging on for dear life.
That's the place to be. I remember when I moved to town, the Sidemen gig was the one, and Jeremy gave me that gig, and I frankly flopped. I had no idea what I was doing. So the first songs, you know, most of us presumably know you as a songwriter. You also are an actual writer. You write just words, liner notes.
That was kind of my entry point into the bluegrass industry, really. I played in some bands in the late 80s, mid 80s, late 80s, early 90s in Southwest Ohio, where I'd moved back around the Cincinnati area. But my older son was born in 1990, and I was a stay-at-home dad, so I was at home. And the internet was kind of like just getting going. And I had nothing to do all day when the baby was sleeping. So I started doing stuff and came across there was a bluegrass listserv back in the day. I mean, this is 93, 94. And Ken Irwin from Rounder Records and a bunch of industry people were on there. And I started writing up about shows that I'd seen and records that I listened to and stuff. And that I got drafted to do some journalism writing, and then the liner notes and all that sort of followed from that.
That's awesome. The first songs you recorded were in your band Union Springs.
Union Springs, yes.
That wasn't your first band, but that was your first bluegrass band.
That was the first band that I was a partner in, so to speak. It was a pretty democratic band. It was
The first band you lost money in.
It was the first band I lost. Yes, exactly. Dwight McCall, the son of Jim McCall, who's one of the great legendary Baltimore bluegrass singers, and Dwight went on to have a great career with the Country Gentlemen and with J.D. Crow.
Yeah.
On a couple of different stints, but he and I and a couple of other friends started that band. Well, actually, we quit playing for somebody else and started our own band. That's a bluegrass story.
I was going to say, once again, a tale as old as time. There's a little band I'm in. It's called the String Dusters, and that was the name of the game.
Same
for
deal.
Us.
Yep.
Everybody had gigs, but we wanted to lose money in our own band.
Well, that was Union Springs. We lost a lot of money, but we did. Those were my first records, and that was when I started writing songs. So I was already 40 years old by then, and I had never written a song in my life until the local record label. We went to them and said we want to make a record, and you know this was in the days before Project Studios and all that. So you had to find like an actual studio and a label and all that. We did, and the guy said, I'll make a record for you, but you have to write some originals.
Right. You need songs.
And so I thought, let me get my pencil out and see what I can do. And
totally.
That started.
Well, my understanding is, you know, by the way, you've had some really cool band names along the way, I might point out, including the Comet All-Stars.
Comet All-Stars.
Which is pretty clever. The Lazy Boys. But my favorite is the Lonesome Heirs.
The Lonesome Heirs, yes.
H-E-I-R-S. And that involved, there's two people I play with regularly that are in that. Andy Falco and Jeremy Garrett are also Lonesome Heirs. You have a way with words. So you're in Union Springs and you're performing these songs. This is the story. Tell me if I'm wrong. So
this
is and again, another tale as old as time. You had a band member leave the band, Chris Davis.
Yes.
And he one of those songs that he played while he was in the band, it had the effect that you want songs to have where when he wasn't playing it in the band anymore, he still wanted to play it. And so he, as he went on to other bands, he was playing it in other bands. And you knew this. You knew this because you pay attention. And so you were at Bean Blossom, and you knew he was going to play the song. And so you knew John Chapman of the Chapmans. Uh-huh. And so you thought it might be a good song for the Chapmans. So you suggested that he listen to Chris play your song that afternoon.
Yep.
And this is what you said. You said he did, and he liked it. And subsequently recorded it, and then he asked if you had anything else.
He asked if I had anything else, and I had one song, which actually we had just worked up. I wrote when we were going to make records, which is another story as old as time. We're going in the studio. We need some songs.
Totally.
So we had just started the band's just started to think about making another record. I wrote one song. We kind of worked it up, and then the band broke up. And so John Chapman asked me, I said, well, I have this one song, and it took me a while to find a rehearsal tape of it, and I sent it off to him, and they cut it, and it became a big bluegrass hit of 2001.
Well, and at that point, you tasted blood, because because you realized that there was, if you could like crystallize inspiration, bring songs into form, or sometimes they call this songwriting.
Yeah.
If you could sort of make these things up, then there were a whole host of musicians who were dying to do the hard work of recording and performing these songs. You know?
Yes. And what happened was I moved to Nashville right at the end of 2002 to play with Chris Jones. And as soon as I moved there, he went off on about 8 months of a tour with the Chieftains. So I was sitting in Nashville, nothing to do, no money. And I thought I had just done my first co-write. And I thought, well, this is a good way to spend some time. I'll hang out with people. We'll write songs together. Maybe something will happen someday. And so that's what I started doing was writing at that point, just for lack of anything else to do.
Well, I think there's a lot of us that are in that. There's a lot of people right now that are working a lot on music because they don't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
You know, making up music. So you taste blood, and you realize that you can write songs. And that people will record them. And this is something that it's actually incredibly uncommon for a songwriter to make up songs and have other people record them.
Yeah, there's a model for it in Nashville in the country music industry. You know, there are great songwriters who are Harlan Howard being an obvious example, who he wrote songs. He didn't really sing them. He was not a performer. He wrote songs. And so that was, I kind of thought, okay, well, I can do that. And I could.
Yeah, and you do.
I do, yeah.
You do. And I think one of, like, you know, one of, you have, there's a couple of things that I think are really, really special about you. And one of them is, you know, we always call our guitar player Andy Falco, we call him the bluegrass diplomat, because he's got everyone on speed dial. But really, I think that title probably belongs to, because you have, not only do you have relationships sort of across the entire pseudo nouveau bluegrass spectrum, but you also have this ability to sort of put all that stuff in context, right? And not only in like a historical context, but even in sort of like the present context. You have an uncanny ability of sort of being able to zoom out and understand how so many of these pieces fit together.
Well, I really like bluegrass, and that's kind of the starting point. And I've always felt, and some of this comes from being in Ohio. The Ohio bluegrass scene going back to the 1950s was a really kind of, it was not a rigid scene. You would find, and this is true into the 80s and 90s, you would go into a little hillbilly bar somewhere and you'd see a band with a guitar player and a drummer and an upright bass player and a banjo and a piano or a pedal steel guitar, some like random assortment of instruments, and that would be, and they would do bluegrass songs among other songs, and it was all kind of one big mess.
There we go.
And I really like that.
Like leftover salmon.
Yeah. Well, I've always had an appreciation for like this big range of bluegrass music, from the traditional, from Flat and Scruggs, which I love, through the Osborne Brothers, who had drums and pedal steel on all their stuff, to, you know, when the kind of jam grass scene got going, I thought, well, this is pretty cool, because here are these bands that are doing their own thing, but they also every once in a while will throw a Bill Monroe song in or something like that. So it's all part of the same big bluegrass world. And I think having that kind of attitude has helped me in writing with people from all the different parts of that world, because I can kind of meet them on their ground without imposing my own idea of what bluegrass is.
Right. Well, you have good taste, but you don't tend to get hung up on. You don't seem like someone who gets hung up on judgments about music. Does that make sense?
No, it makes complete sense. All the time that I spent writing articles about music and writing reviews, I wrote hundreds of record reviews, and I realized fairly quickly that from my point of view, the last thing that anybody wanted to know was whether I liked an album or whether I thought it was good. And then what the most important thing for me to do is describe it well. That's what a good review does. It describes the music so that you have some idea of whether you think you might like it or not. And debates about what bluegrass is or what good music is or all that stuff, just I'm not interested.
No.
Not interested.
No, and in fact, we aren't even going to talk for one second.
Good.
About that organization with four letters. We're not even going to go there. Because that conversation, while we have it incessantly, it's more boorish all the time. This sort of definition of music and even qualitative judgments about music. I mean, determining if something is good or bad or if it that's just.
Yeah, no, it's you like it or you don't.
Yeah.
You like it or
and there's
you
no
don't.
Accounting for taste.
Yeah.
You know, your synthesis, one of the things that you're doing right now, your networking, your sort of connectivity is, you know, that's critical to sort of your success, it seems like, and it's essential role that you play for the scene, drawing connections between potentially disparate individuals. Now, you've been working on this project, Bluegrass at the Crossroads.
Yes.
At the record label you were associated with. Is it safe to say that you do A&R there?
I do A&R for Mountain Home Music Company and Organic Records, which is a more eclectic imprint.
And you've been doing these sessions down there. So, for example, you asked me to come in and play a session, and it was Sammy Sheeler and Wayne Benson. And, you know, those guys are both highly influential, specifically Sammy Sheeler. And they're I consider them to be at least a full generation above me, a bluegrass generation, you know, however those are determined. But then you also had the good sense to kind of go out the other direction, and you had Joe Cicero, who's a bluegrass generation, maybe two. Time will tell how that all works out. Behind me, he came up through ETSU, plays in Fireside Collective, and then Carly Arrowwood, am I saying that right?
Yep.
Who's developing her own solo career and anchored the epic bluegrass gospel track we recorded, Lift Your Voice.
Yeah.
So you had this, I'll never forget that session, the opportunity to play out, like to play and hang out with Sammy Sheeler, who's really nothing like I imagined. He's like so much more amazing and interesting than I ever could have imagined. I mean, I'll never forget that session, putting that group of people together, and it ended up being a really wonderful time.
Well, this project is really near and dear to my heart. And on that was the second session that we did. The previous session, we had Skip Cherry Holmes from Sideline, formerly Cherry Holmes, part of the Cherry Holmes family. Skip, we had Darren Nicholson from Balsam Range, so local hero, one of the top bluegrass bands in the country. Jeremy Garrett from the infamous String Dusters. A wonderful bass player here in town named Kevin Kerberg, who teaches music out at Warren Wilson College and plays with Zoe and Cloyd.
Awesome.
And what am I missing? And Kristen Scott Benson.
Right.
Five-time banjo player of the year, winner of the Steve Martin Prize.
Member of the Grascals, right.
Member of the Grascals. So, again, I mean, that is one of the – and that's what the Lonesome Heirs was in a way as well, which was Jeremy, me, Andy Falco, Jesse Brock, wonderful traditional-oriented mandolin player, and Ned Lubarecki, who can play anything on the banjo. But I've really found – especially now that I'm not touring and not performing on a regular basis, that putting these combinations to different people. And I knew, or at least I felt confident, that you guys would all really enjoy playing together and hanging out together. And that's a part of the way of knitting this whole community together to keep it going for another generation or two.
Yeah, well, and the music that came out of those sessions is really awesome. I mean, you've got the Darren Nicholson song just came out, and I think I sang on that, right? I sang baritone, and Jeremy sang tenor.
Yep.
And that song's awesome. And then one that we wrote is coming out April 30th.
Yes.
What is that called?
It's called On a Lonesome Breeze.
That's right.
Yeah. And that song we wrote a long time ago. I think actually, now that I think about it, I think that was the first one that we wrote together.
I think it might have been.
I think it was the first one that we wrote together, and it had a chord in it that I didn't care for.
So you omitted it.
X'd it out, and I was a little nervous about presenting that to you. I remember that, but you know, I mean, these songs, I've written a lot of songs, and some really stick in my mind, and I will just I'm going to get those cut, and that was one of those songs. I had another one that I did on my first solo album. Called Aim High, that Mark Simos and I wrote, a wonderful songwriter up in the Boston area. And I pitched that song to Steve Gulley four times. And he turned it down three times, and the fourth time he cut it, and it went to number one. So I felt vindicated.
That's great.
I'm willing to wait a long time be vindicated.
You're like, seriously, dude, record my song. He's like, no. You're like, okay, I'll be back in a week. Try again.
Or a couple of years.
Yeah, you just got to stay on them. That's great. So you've done a lot of writing. You've done liner notes for like 100 records. And you were IBMA's, I said I wasn't going to say it, IBMA's first songwriter of the year.
Yes.
Now, weren't you on the committee that created that award?
I was the songwriter committee was created in part to lobby for the addition of that award.
Because I think that's actually pretty genius.
Well, that's...
And it's a little like what I've done with this show.
I'll tell you a funny story about that.
Please.
It's a brief one. So the Songwriter of the Year Award, the IBMA gives, they have industry awards, the Broadcaster of the Year, Event of the Year, and so forth. And so when they created the Songwriter of the Year Award, instead of putting it with the regular music awards that get presented in the big show and then at night, they had it included as an industry award that got presented in the afternoon. So that afternoon, they gave the award away. I won it. I was very excited. And that evening, the award show was at the Ryman Auditorium, the mother church of country music. And I was so excited, and I took my lovely wife. We hadn't been married all that long at that point, and I told her, I'm one songwriter of the year, and they're going to call my name because part of the, just like they do with the Grammys, they would read off the names of the people in ceremonies earlier this afternoon.
Right.
Awards were presented in these categories. And Lori Lewis, bless her heart, got up there, and she was reading them off, and broadcast of the year's this, event of the year's that, and she said, and songwriter of the year went to Donna Ulysses. And my lovely wife turned to me and said, you're a liar.
You're like, no, I've got the award back at the hotel, I swear.
That's funny, man. The award show mix-ups.
They so, happen.
So classic, man. So I was going to say, yeah, I like that you were part of a steering committee that created an award that you later won. That's really good work, and that's the kind of forward thinking I expect from you. And I was going to say it's a little bit like what I did with this show. Like, I've always wanted to be a talk show host, but no one was going to hire me, so I just started my own show. Yeah. It's like, if you want to win this award, it doesn't exist. Just invent the award. Yeah. Well, no one deserves it more than you. I mean, you've written songs that would be recorded with the String Dusters. You probably had. You've had a song on every single String Dusters record. I'm almost positive.
Not the first, but everything after that, yeah.
I mean, you've Del McCurry Band, Doyle Lawson and Quicksilver, Balsam Range, Blue Highway, O'Connor Band, Sierra Hall, Jim Lauderdale, Joe Mullins, Lindsay Lou, Billy Strings. The list goes on and on. You've done some radio DJ for a while.
Yes.
Cincinnati.
Yes. I spent about 2 years working at a station called WOBO doing a 4-hour bluegrass show, and then I went from there to WYSO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. So that was a nice return to my birthplace. And then I gave it up for a number of years until 2006, when I got drafted into first producing and scripting and then eventually co-hosting, handpicked with Del McCurry on Bluegrass Junction on satellite radio. And that was a great gig.
That sounds like a great gig.
Every week I went down to Del McCurry's house and we sat and talked about bluegrass music and listened to records for an hour.
That sounds like, it sounds like your dream come true, man.
It was a good time.
A bluegrass lifer and historian like you.
Well, and the thing is, I will say about Del, and I also feel this way about Roland White, who I played with the whole time, almost the whole time I was living in Nashville and produced an album on. These are guys whose careers go back to the 1950s. And if anybody was entitled to be like, that's not bluegrass, that's not the way that we used to do it and all that, it's them, because they really did used to do it. And they are the most open-minded, and that was kind of the premise of the Del McCurry of Handpicked, and still is that Del McCurry is at the top of this giant mountain of bluegrass that goes in all directions. And that's just really important to me to keep up.
Yeah, he's pretty much at the top. I mean, there's kind of no one else around from his generation.
Yeah.
Or prior that has what he has, which is so beyond the music that he makes and the songs that he sings, and it has to do with the person that he is and the vibration of his family and of his band and the way that they are as people. You know, the McCurrys, you can kind of bundle them all together. They're all really cut from that same cloth of being incredibly open-minded and incredibly loving people and very grateful.
They have had a huge impact on the bluegrass scene in Nashville, certainly, and really around the world.
So you arrived in Nashville in 2003, which was like 2 years before me, and you were living at the bluegrass compound next door to Andy Hall and Janice. We were overlooking the Cumberland River, and I stayed in that guest room there for a little while when I was getting my feet. And I even remember the weekend of my audition for the String Dusters, there was like a typical mega party at the compound, you know, where there was these two houses and plenty of yard. And that was such a good, that was such a good time to be in Nashville, you know, 05 to 2010.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
wonderful. But now you're... Now you're here.
Why, I'm here.
You left Nashville. What drew you to this part of the country?
Well, it's a really gorgeous part of the country. And that was seriously the starting point. My wife and I realized a couple of years ago that once she retired from her job, we had for a long time thought that we would move into Nashville, and that sort of the prices went up and that was no longer an option. And then we thought, well, we're not staying out here kind of in nowhere. We could live anywhere because the Night Drivers, I was playing with Chris Jones at the time, and Chris lives near the North Pole, and the banjo player lived in Northern Virginia, and the mandolin player lived in Southern Illinois. So, you know, travel was built into being in that band.
Yeah.
And Western North Carolina was an area that both of us really liked. And we came down here just to kind of scout around for places to live, and I sort of got offered a job working for Mountain Home Music Company, and it took a couple. They reeled me in over a period of about a year, but that was the deciding factor. So,
yeah, well, we're really glad to have you down here.
Well, I love it. I love it here.
Yeah, well, I mean, what's not to love? We've only sat down to write a handful of times. I only count like maybe six, but so far, I think you've pointed out we have a pretty good batting average. We've recorded most of the songs. As far as I can tell, the first song we wrote was with Jeremy. I think Windy in Nashville was the first one we wrote back in about 2008. And then we did On a Lonesome Breeze in January of 2009. And that comes out next month.
Yep.
So it's been a long time coming, that one. We'll play that one tonight. A Little Too Much.
Yeah.
Which is a song that I like, and I changed some chords in it that you didn't like. Which is, you know,
it's how it goes.
Turnabout is fair play. Yeah. A Night on the River, which is probably the sort of most played song that we've written. That was on the String Dusters record, Silver Sky. We wrote that in maybe 2009 or 2010. And then we went for a long time. It wasn't until August of this year we wrote Pearl of Carolina, which is based on sort of the theme of this show. And then what may end up being our ultimate legacy, we got together with Sean Lane in December and wrote a Christmas bluegrass song.
Tell Ma I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Tell Ma I'll Be Home for Christmas. And hopefully that'll see the light of day. But most of those have been, you know, Blown on Lonesome Breeze got cut, Night on the River, Pearl of Carolina is going to be on the Dusters record. What about A Little Too Much? Did something happen with that one?
I don't think anything has happened yet.
Well, we'll play it tonight and then I'll maybe record it and put it out. So let's get into your head a little bit, John. Why do you do what you do? Write songs, A&R, write liner notes, play bass, beyond the obvious need for a paycheck.
Yeah.
What motivates you? Like, what's the point?
I spent a good chunk of my life working in professions that were unrelated to music. But I have loved music all my life, and I've been playing music all my life, and I've been creative about it all my life. And I realized somewhere along the way, I quit my day job when my son was born in 1990, and when I started to think about going back to work again once the boys were old enough, I thought, well, I don't want to go back to doing that stuff. Let me see if I can make a living in the world of music, because that is what I think about. The mother of my son once told me, she said, I never ask you what you're thinking about anymore, because it's always one thing, it's music. And it's really kind of true, you know. If I'm not focused on some other task, that's what's going through my head. And I think that's true of many musicians, you know. And so the opportunity to build a career in, and I would say the other thing that I figured out fairly early on is that there are day jobs that are music unrelated. There's playing music. And then there's this whole area around that that is also music related, that's also can be that's creative and interesting and part of building that community and being part of the community, writing liner notes and doing radio shows and writing songs and all that. You add that all up. There was for most of this century, I didn't make even half of my income doing one thing. Right. You know, it was touring, yep, and writing songs and doing a radio show and writing other stuff. But it was all centered around music, and that's still what gets me up every morning.
It's the love of the music. You love it. I mean, you're not young, John.
Nope.
You're not young, but you're still incredibly productive. Like, you're probably like at least as productive as you've ever been.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you continue to write songs, you're pouring energy into Crossroads, you even took this gig. How do you do it? How do you have how do you do it? One foot in front of the other, I guess.
Get a good night's sleep and lots of exercise. No, I mean, you know,
you wake up in the morning thinking about the next bluegrass at the Crossroads section, or you get, you know, it's part of your life. I think you already answered the question.
Yeah, you know, and that's my father, who is 98 years old now, quit his. He was a history professor and a writer, and he decided he didn't like the academic world, and he just wanted to write. And he became a freelance writer in about 1975 or so. And that has sustained his career. He's done all kinds of great things that are all circle around that writing. And so I had a model of sorts, somebody look at who put together a living, a freelance living, and to have that kind of model really helps a lot.
Oh, that has to be huge. Because I know that's a huge stumbling point for a lot of creative people, is just not having any idea how to make it pay.
I think people tend to think of the one thing, like I'm going to be a touring musician, or I'm going to play in the studio, or I'm going to perform. That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, especially now when touring's cut off, then you think, okay, well, I'll perform when I can, but I'm going to write some songs. I'm going to give lessons.
Sure.
I'm going to do, you know, but if doing music-related stuff, when you conceptualize a career that way, it lets you be a lot more flexible and take advantage of things as they come along.
Yeah, totally. Take advantage of opportunities instead of having to push your rock up the hill all the time. What do you think about when you lie awake at night? What keeps you up at night?
I work on a lot of different projects, and it's interesting because, I mean, having just talked about it, I have all this variety of things that I put together to make a living, I'm now also managing a lot of different things, but I'm still not used to them all being in this category of stuff, like, well, okay, I need to find some musicians to play on this session that's coming up, and did I remember to make charts for the session tomorrow, and we need to write some stuff for a press release, and what am I going to say, because all that kind of stuff.
You're really in it, man. You're in it.
But I will say it does not keep me up at night a lot, because I feel like I work with a great team at the label. I work with great musicians, with people who I've been friends with. Some are new friends, but a lot of them are people that I've known for 10, 15, 20 years. So it's being a part of a community and having a job that lets me contribute in the ways that I like to contribute, and I think I'm pretty good at, that makes for, you know, I go to bed at night and I go to sleep.
You sleep well. What do you, you mentioned your father before, He was freelance.
Yeah.
Writer. What's something beyond what you already told us? What else is something you learned from your father?
I learned a lot about American history. He's an American historian, and I will say that one of the things that I have found that brings a lot of different kinds of people together with a lot of different attitudes is an appreciation for some of the fundamentals of American history and American government. You know, the guys who wrote the Constitution were flawed in many ways, in some really deep and profound ways, but they also created a structure of governance that has basically continued to work in all these years. And I spent some time in the late 1970s working on doing kind of lobbying and human rights work around the dictatorship in Chile. And Chile had 150 years of elections, and then no more elections. They had a military coup. And so that always gave me an appreciation that we have had even a longer period of time. And wouldn't it be good to keep things that way? And I got my passion for that from my dad, definitely.
Yeah, that's really cool. What color is your front door?
Brown.
Nice. I don't think I've gotten that one yet. If you could jam with any bluegrass musician, alive or no longer living, who would it be?
Oh, boy, that's a lot of choices. Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, great.
Earl Scruggs. I played three songs with Earl Scruggs at a birthday party for him 1 year. And that was exciting.
I believe it. I mean, Earl's the one. Just two more questions, John. What are you afraid of? You afraid of anything?
I'm afraid of making bad music.
Good. Yeah. Good.
I mean, I work hard to make it good. Having music out there that has my name on it that is not good,
right,
is a very unpleasant feeling.
That's
I don't have much
night.
Of it, but there's a couple of songs that I kind of wish that maybe I hadn't written.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's what happens when you do all that co-writing.
Right. Well, you have to turn over the reins to some extent. That's also what happens when you write about a million songs. There's going to be a few in there that maybe you just didn't realize they were a turd.
No, I usually have a pretty good idea.
All right. And finally, John, what is it that you're happy about?
I'm happy about living in Western North Carolina, seriously. I wake up every morning in our little house in Brevard. You've been there. We've got a creek running through the backyard, and I look out at the trees and the mountains and the sun coming up, and I think, man, this is a good place to live.
I love it, man. I couldn't agree more. Everybody, John Weisberger, thanks so much, man. Thanks for letting me pick your brain a little bit.
Absolutely.
Down an old dirt road, some forgotten street, dust clouds rising up from my dragon feet. Can't remember when I last saw her face. Seems like such a waste. I live with no goodbye, such a whirlwind rush. Don't remember why, can't say that I remember much. Doesn't seem to be a reason to return. The bridge is burned. I've been walking day and night, I'm dying on my feet. Too long since I've had a night of sleep. And I can hear it calling me, the love I've known to come back home. Poor Carolina. Time gone, long time left to go. I'm not ready yet. Still, I know the days are getting short, the nights are getting cold. I'm growing old, giving up all I've owned, everything I've gained. All I thought I wanted, only this remains. Go and see the Pearl of Carolina shine one more time. Yeah, I've been walking day and night, I'm dying on my feet. Too long since I've had a night of sleep. I can hear it calling me, the love I've known, come back home. Poor Carolina, poor Carolina, yeah, the poor Carolina.
One of the first tunes we wrote, you and I got together with Jeremy Garrett up at his house, and we were having one of those. It was turned into a little bit of a Nashville gripe session. You know, the weather was bad, and you hear musicians, you know, complain about lonesome hard living in Nashville. We figured we'd give it some voice. It's called Windy in Nashville.
A 1, 2, 3, 2. Well, it's windy in Nashville today. I don't think that I'm gonna stay. Hard as it blows, it won't take me away. Been here too long, just singing my song. It's windy in Nashville today. It's hard luck in Nashville tonight, as the band's playing under the lights. 3 a.m. Broadway is a blinking its eyes. Keep playing on till the last drink is gone. Well, it's hard luck in Nashville tonight. Sun's shining, but the sky is still gray. My dues piling up like the bills I can't pay. Night after night, they're always inside. Yeah, it's hard luck in Nashville tonight. Session is headed for dawn. Suits have gone home, but the mics, they're still on. Don't play from the heart, just follow the chart. Well, it's windy in Nashville today.
Thank you. Windy in Nashville. Do another tune.
Another wind tune.
Another tune about the wind. That's right. Another tune about the lonesome wind. You know, we got a joke in the Dusters about how Weisberger can find a way to fit the word lonesome into any song. And so when I got done writing that Christmas song with John, first thing I did when he left the house, as I texted my bandmates, I said, you guys will not believe this. I just wrote a Christmas song with Weisberger, and guess what word we managed to fit into a Christmas song? And sure enough,
in there. Yep.
Three of them guessed it simultaneously. They all knew. So there's a song, Blown on a Lonesome Breeze. This a version of this with Sammy Sheeler and a whole bunch of other awesome people will be out Bluegrass at the Crossroads on April 30th.
Bluegrass at the Crossroads.
This has been the Travis Book Happy Hour Podcast. Thanks for listening. Huge thanks to John Weisberger, Tommy Marr, Thompson Guitars, Americana Vibes, and the Bluegrass Situation. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe and leave a positive review. It really helps us out. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at the Travis Book Happy Hour and online at thetravisbookhappyhour.com. And remember, it's okay to be happy.